This is Philosophy Bites with me, David Edmonds.
And me, Nigel Warburton.
Philosophy Bites is available at www.philosophybites.com.
This podcast is brought to you with support from the Mark Sanders Foundation. We live in an increasingly uncertain and complex world with a casual attitude towards objective facts. Citizens often don't know what the truth is or where to find it. The Mark Sanders Foundation has the toolkit to address this global issue, philosophy. Through academic excellence and inclusive outreach programmes, the Mark Sanders Foundation helps deepen understanding through innovation in philosophy for a more informed world. Learn more at www.marksandersfoundation.org. And that's Mark with a C, M-A-R-C, sandersfoundation.org.
I'm pretty sure that you're listening to me speak right now, but presumably you could have chosen to do something else. Presumably you could have decided to go shopping instead. What other worlds are possible? Is it possible to imagine that rather than listening to Philosophy Bites, you chose instead to buy a one-way ticket to North Korea? Helen Beebe is fascinated by possible worlds.
Helen Beebe, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
Hi, Nigel. It's great to be here.
The topic we're going to focus on is possible worlds. That sounds like something out of science fiction. What is a possible world and why would it matter to a philosopher?
Perhaps the best way to start thinking about it is to think about the way in which possible worlds were introduced into philosophy, which happened a really long time ago. So Gottfried Leibniz in the late 17th, early 18th century very famously said that we live in the best of all possible worlds. And he said that in the context of worrying about the problem of evil. So the problem of how it can be that there's an omniscient, benevolent God who creates a world where there's all this pain and suffering. And Leibniz's thought was, look, God had a choice when he created the universe. He could have set up the initial conditions differently. He could have set up the laws of nature differently. Because he had a choice and he's benevolent, clearly he does things for a reason. This must be the best of all possible worlds. Otherwise, he would have selected one of those other possible worlds and we'd be living in that one and not this one. And Leibniz sort of believed in possible worlds, I think. So he did think of them as ways the world could be, where God sets up the initial conditions and the laws and he has lots of choice about how he might do that. And once you've set up the initial conditions and the laws and you just let everything run its course, you're going to get these really different ways in which things pan out, right? So here we are in the actual world. We've got the universe, we've got galaxies, we've got stars, we've got the Earth, we've got human beings and so on. Of course, if you set the initial conditions and the laws up differently, you're going to get a whole different kettle of fish. This is not just Earth, this is whole alternative universes. You're going to get alternative universes where nothing very much happens at all. You're going to get ones where the Earth never comes into existence. You're going to get ones where human beings never evolve and so on and so on. So that's the basic idea. Another way you might think of it is kind of when you read a work of fiction, actually, especially science fiction, because their scope tends to be so much broader, you can think of what the author is doing in a way is kind of telling you about a small corner of a possible world. So you think about the Sherlock Holmes stories. You might think of that as saying a little bit about some very constrained spatio-temporal region of some possible world where there are all these people, Sherlock Holmes and Moriarty and so on. And if you start with that and then think, all right, so what would it be to tell a story about a whole possible world? You can kind of take the Sherlock Holmes stories and expand them back in time and forward in time and kind of across all of space, fill out all of the details, and then you've got a possible world.
Going back to the example from Leibniz, Voltaire famously mocked that in Candide because it was fairly obvious to him that there must be some possible world in which people are much nicer to each other than they are in the real one.
Yes, that is a worry for that particular response to the problem of evil. I mean, once you take the idea of possible worlds seriously, it's very hard to agree with Leibniz. There really couldn't be a better possible world than this one. You know, take any bit of suffering and think, oh, really, come on, surely there's a possible world where that didn't happen and surely that's a bit better than the actual world. So yeah, that's not a very convincing response to the problem of evil, I don't think.
So let's talk about the word possible. Just because we can imagine something doesn't mean it actually could happen, does it?
That's a worry for talk about possible worlds. So the reason why philosophers nowadays are really interested in possible worlds is because they're really interested in making sense of what's known as modality. So claims about what's necessary, what's possible, what might have been, how things might have gone differently. Philosophers obviously find everything puzzling, but they find modality particularly puzzling. We think of, and this is not just philosophers, this is everyone, we make distinctions between things that happened but might not have done. Right? I might have overslept this morning. I might have missed the bus. Those are things that didn't happen but could have done. Whereas some things we think couldn't have been different. So 2 plus 2 is 4. It's very hard to see how that could have been different. So that seems like it's not just a contingent truth. It's a necessary truth. And philosophers want to make sense of that difference. And they also want to make sense of what's known as counterfactual talk. So I say things like, well, if I'd overslept by 5 minutes this morning, I still would have made it in time. But if I'd overslept by an hour, I would have been late. We're very good at making those kinds of counterfactual claims in general in everyday life. We might argue about some of them, but we have quite a good grip on which ones are true and which ones aren't. And again, that's very puzzling. It's like, what makes these claims true or false? And what possible worlds give you is a way of understanding modality. So when I say that it's just contingently true that I'm sitting here today, it could have been otherwise. I might have been somewhere else. You can understand that impossible worlds talk by saying, well, okay, that's true at the actual world, but there are possible worlds where it's not true, right? There are possible worlds where I'm not sitting here, I'm doing something completely different right now. And similarly, when you say that something couldn't have been different, when I say 2 plus 2 is 4, that's a necessary truth. We take that to mean 2 plus 2 is 4 is true in all possible worlds. So it's a way of understanding or kind of reducing that really puzzling modal talk about what might or might not have happened, into some talk that ends up just being talk about possible worlds. So that's why it's a really useful thing for philosophers.
But why is it useful to be able to describe it in those terms? I mean, why is it useful to be able to say that rather than if I had overslept, I wouldn't be here, there is a possible world in which I overslept and didn't get here? What's the use of that different way of talking?
It's partly just a sort of bit of technical machinery. We have these unanalyzed notions of necessity and possibility and contingency. And the idea is we get to analyze all of those in the same way just by using this very straightforward device. There's a kind of deeper metaphysical reason why you might want to do that as well. So the American philosopher David Lewis, I think, was partly interested in possible worlds for a kind of deeper metaphysical reason than some philosophers are, which was to do with being really puzzled by the nature of necessity. So David Hume, back a couple of centuries ago, was really worried about the nature of necessity. He was worried about causation, and he didn't really see how it could make sense to say that one thing guaranteed that something else would happen, it would necessitate it. He found this a really puzzling notion. And I think Lewis shared some of that puzzlement about the nature of necessity. And what you get to do when you move from just talking about necessity to talking about possible worlds is, as it were, you suck all of the necessity out of the world. You don't need to think that there's any necessity in the world, because all our necessity talk just gets cashed out in terms of all these other worlds, right? So you don't need to think of necessity as being a part of any world. You get necessity talk coming out of talking about, as it were, the space of possible worlds. So that's a kind of metaphysical reason for wanting to take them seriously.
Well, while we're on metaphysics and what exists, I think I'm right in saying that some philosophers don't just use this as a tool. They really believe that these other possible worlds actually exist in the same sense as the one we're now in.
Yes. So David Lewis very famously did believe that. And he did say that typically the response he got to expressing that belief was what he called the incredulous stare. And he was worried about whether the incredulous stare kind of counted as an argument. Like, does this have any weight in philosophical arguments about this? Lewis's view was, look, they're an incredibly useful device, not just for understanding modality, but a whole range of other things. And his line was, when something's that useful, you should just believe in it. He made the analogy with sets in mathematics. It's like sets are a really strange thing, right? There's Nigel, and then there's the set that has Nigel as its member. Different thing, really puzzling. Lewis's line was, okay, they're a bit strange, but you can't do maths without sets, so you should believe in them. Similarly for possible worlds. And he thought that what possible worlds are real concrete entities, right? So there's a real alternative universe where there are people going around doing the things that happen in the Sherlock Holmes stories. Like, they're real flesh and blood people. The Sherlock Holmes there is smoking a real pipe and eating real food and sitting at a real table, just as much as we are. They're not sort of strange abstract entities. They're real concrete things.
Just to get that clear, David Lewis believed that there is a possible world in which England won every single World Cup ever.
That's exactly right. You are giving me the incredulous stare now. And I'm very sympathetic to the incredulous stare. I myself, I'm not really sure what to think. I'd like there to be another story about what possible worlds are that is less weird. And there are other stories out there. So, for example, there's a position that's known as ersatzism. And what ersatzists say is, we should more think of this as kind of the stories. So if you go back to the Sherlock Holmes example, you take the Sherlock Holmes novels and you kind of extend the story back into the past and into the future and across all of space, and you get this huge, massive story. Lewis thinks that's a story that's genuinely true at some possible what. All this stuff really happens somewhere out there in logical space. I'm getting the incredulous stare again. What the ersatzist says is, no, we just have the story. So when we say that something's true at a possible world, all we mean is there's a consistent story in which that happens. There's a possible world where there are talking donkeys. Lewis, who's a realist about possible worlds, and the ersatzists agree that that claim is true, and that's why it's true that there could have been talking donkeys. What the ersatzist says is, no, look, there's a perfectly sensible story you can tell, as it were, about an alternative universe that talking donkeys feature in, but we don't need to believe in real talking donkeys. We just have the story. So the story is kind of like this abstract entity, and that's what other possible worlds are.
That seems more attractive to me, because the notion of a possible world is surely one that isn't actual. I mean, we call it possible because it's not actual.
Yeah, so I guess there are two things to say about that. One is that Lewis thinks that all that the word actual is doing is locating us in one of those many possible worlds. So it's not as though the other possible worlds have some sort of shadowy existence, right? They really exist. All we're doing when we say this thing actually happened is saying that it happened in this world rather than some other world. So it's a bit like when I say this is happening here, I'm locating where it's happening. It's not that here has some special metaphysical status relative to other places, right? And the second thing to say is the worry about that ersatzist story where you just have these kind of abstract stories, or Lewis's worry anyway, was we need to have some constraints on what counts as a legitimate story. What's the constraint? Well, the story has to be internally consistent, right? If you look at the Sherlock Holmes stories and discover that in one story it says that Sherlock Holmes was born in such and such a year, and in one of the other stories it says he was born in some other year, that's not an internally consistent story. There can't be a possible world where that story is true, right? Because it would be a story that has a contradiction in it. So consistency is a constraint on what can count as a legitimate story that is a possible world. Consistency is a modal notion, right? To say that some sentences collectively are consistent with each other is just to say that they can all be true together. And the idea of they can all be true together, it's possible for them all to be true together, that's just another modal notion. So his worry was, we haven't really filtered out all the modality. If we do the ersatzist story, we're still left with this primitive notion of what's possible and what's necessary. And that was exactly the notion that we were supposed to be using possible worlds to do away with.
You've talked about questions about necessity. Are there other areas of philosophy that are enlightened by introducing this way of speaking?
Yeah, so one is the notion of a counterfactual conditional. Again, I can say, well, if I got up 5 minutes later, I still would have arrived on time. But if I got up an hour later, I would have arrived late. Lewis thinks you can, and this is a standard view, you can give a possible world story about that. And it basically amounts to, look, when I say, if I'd woken up an hour later, I would have been late, what we do is we imagine a possible world that's very similar to the actual world in almost all respects, but it has a few minor differences that make it the case that I get up an hour later. And now we just kind of run the laws and see what happens in that world. As it turns out, in that world, that closest, most similar world, what happens is that I arrive late. That's why it's true that had I woken up an hour later, I would have been late. Now, Lewis uses that to analyze the notion of causation, which is a really important notion in metaphysics. So he thinks that one thing causing another really just is a matter of it being the case that if the first thing hadn't happened, the second thing wouldn't have happened. He also thinks that you can use possible worlds for a whole bunch of other things. So, for example, there's the notion of a property, right? You have two red things. There's this property that they share. Again, this is a big issue in metaphysics. What does it mean to talk about properties? Lewis thinks that we should just think of properties as kind of sets of possible individuals. So think of the set across all the possible worlds, all the individuals in those possible worlds that are red, that just is what redness is. Similarly, he thinks that the notion of a proposition, so when I say snow is white and you say Schnee ist weiß, we're uttering different sentences, but they mean the same. Standard line to take in philosophy is, well, we're expressing the same proposition, we're just doing it in different languages. But now there's the question, well, what on earth is a proposition? That seems like a really peculiar entity. Lewis's view is, well, a proposition is just a set of possible worlds again. So the proposition that snow is white is just the set of all possible worlds where it's true that snow is white. That sounds a bit circular, but you could kind of do it in a way that sounds a bit less circular.
In the philosophy that you do yourself, have you found this notion of possible worlds has helped you?
Oh, yeah. Pretty much most people these days who work in metaphysics, philosophy of language, all kinds of areas of philosophy, possible world talk is just part of the currency now. Like, everybody talks about possible worlds. So me, I worry about causation quite a lot, and possible world talk comes up there all the time. But philosophers just use that machinery all the time. And so we run up against that question constantly. What are these things? I'm not sure I want to sign up to that Lewis view that these are real concrete entities. That's a worry for me. It's a worry for a lot of philosophers that we're not really sure what to do about that. And I think what we tend to do in practice is just think, all right, there's a kind of division of labour thing here. There are other people that worry about what metaphysical story we should tell about possible worlds. We're going to leave it to them to sort out, and we're just going to happily carry on talking the talk.
Helen Beebe, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more Philosophy Bites, go to www.philosophybites.com. You can also find details there of Philosophy Bites books and how to support us. We now have a few more podcasts. Nigel has one on philosophy and places they're associated with, www.philosophysites.com. And there's also Thinking Books, www.thinkingbooks.co. I have a podcast devoted specifically to moral and political philosophy, www.philosophy247.org. And there's one on the social sciences. Just Google Social Science Bites.